White Rocket Entertainment.
Third down, six to the Auburn 24. Pat's going to leave it with Ball. And he's going to break a tackle. He's going to break another tackle. 35, 40. Down the sidelines. We got a foot race at the 40, the 30, the 20. Bye-bye, Ball. Touchdown, Auburn!
Here's Jeremy Henderson.
Bo Jackson was like He-Man or something. Like it was almost like that, like a toy universe or something. I mean, he was just so, in my mind, he was like a superhero. And my dad actually kicked me out of school to go meet him because he was interning with some business that happened to be working with the business that my mom was at the time. This is like in 1984, preseason. I think it was before school had started. We went and I took a Polaroid with me, and I'm in Bo's lap, and I took it for show and tell. And I mean, I honestly felt growing up, because I had this picture and that I had like set in Bo Jackson's lap, it felt like I had been blessed. This was like a conversation starter until like I was probably a teenager. You know what I mean? I had sat in Bo Jackson's lap.
This is We Believed, a lifetime in the Auburn family. Part 3, Defense Auburn, Defense. Pat Dye, 1984 through 1988.
The 1984 college football season begins tonight. Two top collegiate teams face each other in the second annual Kickoff Classic, presented by Camp Sports. Live from the Meadowlands of New Jersey, the Kickoff Classic features the number 2 ranked Auburn Tigers against number 1, the Hurricanes from the University of Miami. Giant Stadium, a gorgeous August night, temperature in the mid-70s, just a slight breeze, a perfect night for football between two exceptional college football teams. Hi, everybody, I'm Kurt Gowdy. Kickoff Classic. This game now is the signal to start the college football season, the second annual Kickoff Classic. And a classic should be a matchup of two great teams, and that's what we have. Two teams, number 1, Miami of last year, number 3, Auburn, both back with a strong nucleus. Working with me on this Kickoff Classic will be Lenny Dawson. And in this classic game, Lenny, we have a passing and a running style.
Yes, we certainly do, and it's going to be a great confrontation because Miami throws the ball about as much as they run the ball. On the other hand, you've got Auburn, a great running attack with Bo Jackson in there. They'll run the ball 4 times more than they'll pass it. So you're going to see a passing team against a running team.
Both teams have some problems, though, question mark. Miami on defense, Auburn with a starting quarterback.
Well, they got great personnel on both clubs, and it may not be a problem, but something we're going to watch. As far as Miami is concerned, they got to stop Bo Jackson and that running attack, and they're going to do it with inexperienced linebackers. On the other hand, a great running attack for Auburn, but their quarterback is very questionable. Mike Mann is starting for the first time since he graduated from high school, and that was 5 years ago.
So, John, on our last episode, we talked about the arrival of Pat Dye prior to the 1981 season, and we talked about what it was like building up to the 1983 season, which, you know, I guess in some ways came earlier than expected. It seemed like Pat Dye was building towards something, and, you know, 81 was a lot of near misses, but a lot of misses, you know. We were not great, but you could see he was making them tougher. That was the main thing. They were just going to be tough. Tough as old leather, you know. They wouldn't be an easy out. Even if you beat Auburn, they wouldn't be an easy out. And then in 82, with Bo's arrival and settling on Randy Campbell at quarterback and the defense getting even tougher, you could see we were going to be a program to be reckoned with. But I don't know that, and I think everybody felt like 83 could be special. But I don't know if people thought, especially given that schedule, that they would be that special. So the 83 team ended up 11-1 and arguably should have been national champions. And then going into 84, really the only thing we lost our kicker, Al Del Greco, but we have other kickers. I mean, you replace a kicker. But I don't know that people fully appreciated what we would lose when we lost Randy Campbell or Lionel James. But you plug in a Brent Fullwood, a Collis Campbell, a Kyle Collins, and Tommy Agee at fullback. It seemed like the running game was easier to reload. But I want to start out, when we start out looking at 1984 and 85, these sort of bookend seasons that both ended with four losses, and we can talk a little bit about them individually, but I want to get your sense first. When we go into 84, what was your feeling about what we lost? Did you think Randy Campbell would be easier to replace? Do you remember? I know it's been a long time. And just what were you thinking after that 83 season going into 84?
I remember there was a lot of hype because of the way 83 ended and because we felt like we should have been, you know, national champions and stuff. Mm-hmm. There was very high expectations heading into 1984. And we started the season off in the kickoff classic against the team that had beaten us for the national title. So it was a revenge thing.
The number one team last year has defeated Auburn, preseason ranked number one, 20-18. And the most valuable player of the game is Jimmy Johnson, a successful effort. His first game, boy, can he be happy. The pressure on him, he came in to replace the popular Howard Schnellenberger, who carried his team to the miracle season of last year, and Johnson did it, and his team did it.
We were ranked number one, too. We were ranked number one preseason in the AP. And let's clarify, they didn't beat us. They stole the title from us. There's a difference.
Yeah, they stole. I mean, Miami stole the title from us. We should have won it at the end of the 83 season. And I think this is a theme that we will return to in later seasons, which is the Auburn starting out a season highly ranked with high expectations. And it doesn't always work out the way we want it to.
We have to sneak up on them. We can't be predicted wall to wall, right? We have to sneak up, except maybe, you know, 88, 89 were like the two seasons we actually kind of did what we expected. It's always the seasons we're not expected to do great that we really have good years. So, right. So there was a lot of buzz in the air. But what about the quarterback situation? I mean, how much of the blame for how 84 wasn't a bad season? We ended up 9-4. Let's clarify that. We end up 9-4, and if we hadn't played in that preseason kickoff classic, we would have been 9-3, which is a darn fine Auburn season. And in fact, of our four losses, two of them were out of conference in the first 2 weeks of the season. So we only lost two games the whole rest of the season after those two.
Out-of-conference losses to top 10 teams away from home.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's amazing is we didn't even drop out of the top 20 after we started 0-2. That's how much regard they still had for us. We went 0-2. I can't remember a team back then that started out 0-2 and was still in the top 20.
I think it just shows, number one, the schedule was very different at the time, but also it was obvious we were a really good team. We had just played two really good teams.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, we went on the road to East Rutherford, New Jersey, in a neutral site for that kickoff classic where it was, you know, they were always trying to make the kickoff classic, like, mean something beyond just two good teams. So, like, they had Penn State and Nebraska the year before. Penn State had won the championship the year before, but Nebraska was supposed to be the team of the century, you know. So that was a great matchup. And this was like the team that was given the national championship versus the team that thought they earned the national championship. So this was a great matchup. The only problem was that Miami brought basically their whole team back, and we didn't have Randy Campbell, among others. So, again, what do you think in terms of the quarterback? We ended up settling on Pat Washington. And I think Pat was kind of underestimated and underappreciated in his 2 years. But unfortunately, his 2 years, we lost four games each year, and we lost to Alabama both years, and that's not good, you know?
No, it's not. And I think he suffered by comparison to the quarterbacks before and after him. So
right, yeah. I do. I think that Pat Washington, he went on to be an assistant coach. I'm not sure where he is now, but I remember him being a receivers coach for Tennessee for a while. After he graduated, he actually had a geography class the period before me in, I think, 86 or 87. And I'd be standing outside the door waiting to go into the room, and he would come out, and I guess his girlfriend would always be like waking him up, you know, helping him stumble out of the room and waking him up because he was in a stupor from I guess a not very exciting class the hour before mine.
You brought up the quarterback issue, and that was definitely an issue. Like, the team wasn't as efficient at quarterback, but the biggest difference was Bo Jackson.
Yeah, now you say that, But what was our record when Bo Jackson was out those six games?
I don't know. 6-0?
6-0. Now, you can argue, well, those six, I mean, they were, you know, they weren't the hardest on the schedule because he came back for Florida, which we lost. So, yeah, there was this funny statistic. After we lost to Florida on November the 3rd, we were 0-3 with Bo playing and 6-0 without him. But the three that he played in were Miami, Texas, and Florida. You know, so come on. I mean, it's not really, but it is still a funny statistic that in 84, after nine games, we were 0-3 with Bo Jackson and 6-0 without him. So, well, let's look at some of those real quick and see what, just we're going to zip through the 84 season. I want to point out, though, we were still running the wishbone, and we were still not throwing the ball very well at all. So,
no.
So, you know, if you could shut down Bo, it was fairly easy to stop this 84 offense. They, you know, 86 was around the corner coming up where Dye finally just says, forget the wishbone, we're going to try to be more sophisticated. Because I remember him saying that when you run the wishbone, you spend all week not working on the opponent, you work on getting better at running the wishbone. And we wanted to move toward an offense where you actually take game plans into consideration and actually, like, mold your plan around the team you're playing. So we would eventually, and by 86, we're becoming more of a passing team, although still not a tremendous amount. It was like we'd found this new wrinkle in football nobody'd ever heard of, and we were going to do it some.
The forward pass, yeah. Crazy Town.
God, I remember Randy Campbell, when he would throw a long pass, he looked like Atlas trying to heave the earth off his shoulders when he would shoot. He was like doing a shot put trying to throw a long pass. Not the strongest arm, Randy Campbell, but a darn fine option quarterback. All right, so like we said, we go up and we lose to Miami 20-18 in a very tough game in the Meadowlands. And I just hated losing that game, you know, because, gosh, you wanted some revenge on Miami. Even if it wouldn't have given us the national title back, but still, you know, you just wanted to smack them for having the temerity to think they could steal it in the first place.
Yes.
But they won. And then we go to Texas, who was number four. And by the way, Miami, after two games, they went up to number one in the AP rankings. So we played a team that would be number one and a team that was number four, both away from home. Oh, by the way, that Miami team, I believe, ended up 8-5. They didn't even end up as well as we did. And that was the famous Miami team that lost to Doug Flutie on the Hail Mary.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if people realize the Miami team that gave up Doug Flutie's big Hail Mary that won in the Heisman was the same Miami team we played in the Meadowlands. I just think that's interesting. So we're 0-2 after losing a tough game at Texas. And what else did we lose in that game with Texas?
Bo Jackson.
Yeah. Jerry Gray, their defensive back, separated Bo's shoulder, pulling him down on a run. And so we lost 35-27. And that's losing to Texas twice in a row. And, man, after that, I wanted to kill Texas so bad. I wanted to beat them. And 87 couldn't come soon enough, although I didn't know it yet. So we have a few other games. We have a fairly unmemorable game where we beat Southern Miss. We beat Tennessee at home. We go to Ole Miss and win a close game that was actually on TBS. Wow. And then, okay, here's one we got to stop and dwell on for just a minute. Auburn went to Florida State after beating them at home on that last-second interception by Greg Carr the year before in 83. In 1984, we go to Florida State. The game was not on television at all. And Jim Fife called the game of his life.
Here we go. Two tight ends. Fits to Fullwood. He dives. He's in. Touchdown, Auburn. Brent Fullwood hurtled over the pile and went into the end zone from 1 yard out on fourth and goal. And Auburn, on its first series of downs, has struck for a touchdown with 13:01 in the first quarter. Tigers lead it 6-0. Pat Washington into his cadence. Washington will pitch. It'll go to Thomas Campbell, who's in the backfield. Broke a tackle behind the line of scrimmage. 30, 35, 40. He's in the 45. He's in midfield. He's in the 40. Down the sidelines to the 30. 25 to the 20. Still on his feet. It's 15. 10, 5. Touchdown, Auburn! Pat Washington, the quarterback, runs the option pitch. It'll go to Brent Fullwood. He dodges the tackle. He's in! Touchdown, Auburn! Great block by Tim Jesse on the corner. And Fullwood takes it in from 5 yards away. And Auburn moves up 22-10. There's the kick by Barco. 2 yards into the end zone is Fullwood. He'll bring it out to the 5 to the 10, straight up the middle of the field to the 20. Fumble the football. Florida State's going to get it, I believe. Auburn picks it up, and they're going to try to run with it. Can he go? Can he go with it?
It's Eddie Graham who has the football, and he's going to go the distance for a touchdown. Touchdown, Auburn.
Jim,
touchdown, Auburn.
You cannot.
Fullwood fumbled the ball, and Graham picked it up and ran with it.
What is bizarre about it, you can't pick it up and fumble it on the ground. When the ball was fumbled, it bounced and hit the back of someone and popped up in the air to Eddie Graham.
Washington on third and five will pitch to Kyle Collins, turns the corner to the five, got his first down, he drives, he is going to be in, touchdown Auburn!
And what a block by number 14, Freddie Wagin.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a tie score in Tallahassee, Florida. Auburn 35 and Florida State 35 in a wild woolly shootout here in Doak Campbell Stadium. Robert McGinney, a chance to give Auburn the lead. Kicking the point after with Mike Mann to hold. Pat Motes over the ball to snap it. The ball is on the tee. There's the kick, and it's good. And Auburn gets the lead back from Florida State at 36 to 35. I don't know about the players, but I'm running out of gas. Auburn trailing by five. Washington looking, throwing. This one's complete inside the 20 and out of bounds at the Florida State 14-yard line. Washington hitting tight end Jeff Park, driven out of bounds by Mike Hayes. That'll be another Tiger first down. Can it come down to this? Can you stand a finish like this? What an exciting finish it's been. A pitch to Fullwood, got a block on the outside. Brent turns the corner to the 10, broke a tackle to the 5, goes out of bounds at the 5-yard line of Florida State with 1:13 to play. 41-36, the Tigers trail Florida State.
The last time Auburn was in this situation, they ran the option, and Kyle Collins got it in over here on the left corner. Let's see what they do.
Two tight ends for Washington. He's going to pitch the forward, tries to get outside. He dives for the pylon. He's in! He's in! He's in! Touchdown, Auburn! Touchdown, Auburn! Touchdown, Fullwood from 4 yards away! And the Tigers have done it. They've marched literally the length of the field and gone ahead. 42-41.
And what do you remember? Did you get to hear? I mean, were you at that game at Doak Campbell, or did you get to hear on the radio, or
No, neither.
Wow.
I think we got. I was probably listening on the radio, but I cannot be sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember listening to the radio, and I remember I had a notebook. I was lying on the bed, and I had a notebook open in front of me, and I was like diagramming the possessions so that I could keep track of it on paper, you know, while I'm hearing it. And I just remember my paper looked like just zigzags back and forth because this was a track meet, John. This was a ping pong match. This was a pinball machine, as they say. And I mean, I don't remember how the scores played out, although I am going to play some clips here. But what I remember is that it was back and forth. Neither team played a whole lot of defense. And there were also special teams big plays, like a kickoff return that's fumbled and then picked up and run back. Because I remember, I'm sure I'm going to have Fife saying this, but I remember saying, can he go? Can he go? He can go! Touchdown! You know. And I remember that Kyle Collins had a big game. Collis Campbell had a big game. Brent Fullwood did some work. All of our, you know, second, third, fourth string running backs had big nights. And I remember Freddie Wagand caught some big passes, or at least he caught one, I know, but he caught some big passes. And back and forth it went, and I feel like Auburn got the ball back down 41, maybe 35, with just 2 minutes to go or something. And this was when Fife famously said, their backs to the wall, their feet to the fire. You know, that doesn't sound like a comfortable position to be in. And when we scored, he said, the Tigers have done it. They've marched literally the length of the field and gone ahead 42-41. And so, I mean, that's one of those calls that just stands out in my mind all these years later. It was only in front of 58,000 people. In fact, here's an amazing number. When Auburn the week before went to Ole Miss, we played that game in front of 35,000 people. I mean, golly, Vanderbilt thinks that's funny. So, what memories you have of that amazing Florida, number 9 Florida State, number 16 Auburn in Tallahassee?
Mostly my memory is that it's one of those games that people talk about later.
Yeah.
As one of the craziest and most exciting games in Auburn history that very few people saw. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, there aren't a lot of copies of.
No. Yeah, no, there's the highlight VHS tape, which I have around here somewhere that I remember buying because I was like, oh, man, there's actual footage from 84. I got to have this. And I want to say that that was the year that, that maybe Jim Fife pointed out that Florida State were wearing these very plain, almost maroon garnet jerseys. And I feel like he said that Burt Reynolds bought them for the teams. They didn't have enough money to buy jerseys or something.
I believe that.
It's a far cry, Florida State in the early 80s from Florida State in the late 80s and beyond. You know, I mean, that money starts pouring in once Bobby Bowden gets them going. But so we went down there and took Florida State down. That was a great game. And I've got to mention the next one because this is an incredible one too. And I want to see if you remember this because I know that you have a particular affinity for the Auburn-Georgia Tech series growing up in Atlanta, having a lot of friends that went off to Tech and everything, right? Now, remember, this is the Georgia Tech game where I believe, and you may this, I talk about it, it may come back to you. I believe we were just killing them in the first half, and I want to say we were up 41-0 at halftime, and this was a Bill Curry Georgia Tech team, and in the second half, I don't know if we just went to sleep or what happened, but I remember it was 41-0. And it was like 41-7, 41-14, 41-21, 41-28. It ends up, and then we got a score late, I think. And it ends up being 48-34. But I remember when they scored to make it maybe 41-34, I remember thinking, good Lord, we're going to lose a game. We led 41-0 at halftime. Do you remember this at all?
I do, and that is 100% the Georgia Tech rivalry. That's the Georgia Tech rivalry in a nutshell. Like, we don't take them seriously, and it comes back to bite us in the rear end again and again.
Yeah.
But, yeah. No, I mean, again, we used to have a great rivalry with them. We used to play in Atlanta a lot. There was a lot of Auburn fans in that area, and we had it. We were coasting. We were pulling people, and then they got in a roll, and our backups couldn't do anything against them, and that was it.
Yeah. Yeah, it was entirely too close for comfort. When I saw that score, I immediately remembered exactly what happened in that game. Because I just remember listening to it on the radio. This is another one wasn't on TV. And then we were number 13. They were unranked. And I remember thinking, my gosh, they're going to come back all the way. I can't believe this. But we got a late score and made it 48-34. And then we beat Mississippi State in an entirely too close game. Wait, by the way, talking about Georgia Tech, you think that's funny. Wait till we get to 87, right? I know you remember that one.
I was there.
Oh, yeah. That's coming. All right, so November 3rd, we go to number 13, Florida. And this is the game, this one and the next year are like the 2 years when you have so many NFL players on the field that you just don't know it yet. You know, the 84-85 Florida team, they were just loaded with NFL players.
It's the 85 game that's the peak, though.
That, yes.
People can go back and look. The 85 Auburn-Florida game, you know, between the two rosters, again, like 85 players on a team, there was probably 40 guys at least who played serious time in the NFL in that game. It was amazing.
Unbelievable, yeah. So this one is the game where Bo came back after the separated shoulder. We just won those 6 games in a row, and Bo comes back, but that Florida defense was just stifling. We couldn't get anything going on offense, and they scored basically a score every quarter, and won 24-3. And that's how that Florida rivalry was, you know, is it was a streaky thing. We'd won a game or two there. They won a game or two there. Then they won these 3 in a row, 84, 85, 86. And then we won 87, 88, 89. And then they hired Steve Spurrier, and you know how that goes. So,
and I think the Florida defense was amazing. I think they were led by Wilbur Marshall, who went on to play for the Chicago Bears the next year as they went undefeated and won the Super Bowl. So,
yeah, just a huge, just a great defense. They were able to shut our running game down, and we didn't have much passing game. So I have to mention real quickly the Cincinnati game the next week at home. This was the 60-0. This was the biggest blowout I'd ever seen. This is a game where so many backups played that the radio host on 790 The Zone I used to listen to in Atlanta, Chuck Oliver, was like a fifth-string offensive lineman. And I remember him saying something like Pat Dye pointed to him and said, even you get to play Oliver or something. So he even got to go in for a couple of snaps because it was 60-0. So that was huge. I have almost no memories of the Georgia game in 84. We won 21-12 in Auburn. And it's rare for us to beat Georgia in Auburn back then. We always used to win in Athens. They always used to win in Auburn. But do you have any memory of that? You probably remember Georgia better than I do. I just, that game was just kind of...
No. I do not remember much about that game. No. It's weird. I think me and Georgia would leave a big imprint, but I do not.
Georgia was number 15. We were number 18. It was on ESPN, and it must have just been a good old hard-fought Auburn-Georgia Vince Dooley-Pat Dye game, but I have no specific memories of it. And then the next week, 2 weeks later, because we had an off week, I hate to bring this game up, but we're up to number 11 after beating Georgia, and we go up to Legion Field to play Alabama, and this was the 4-6 Ray Perkins' second year horrible Alabama team. And I guess our guys just thought they were going to roll their helmets out there and get a big win. And you know what happens next.
So now it's fourth and goal, and Pat Dye has to make the decision. Do you go for what figures to be the sure field goal and go up by a point, or do you try for the touchdown? That's his decision right now.
I think I'm going for the sure field goal.
I do too, with all that's at stake for him right now. Fourth down goal. Inside the 1 yard line. Bennett has come back in defensively. And Dye has elected to go for it. To go for the touchdown. So the critical play of the game right here. On fourth down and goal. It's Fullwood, and he is stopped. And will they talk about that play for years? With 3:27 to go in the game, Rory Turner ran him out of bounds, and that will be forever ingrained in the lore of this rivalry. If this final score doesn't change, they'll be talking about that from now to the year 2020 in Birmingham.
We lost.
15-17. And we had many chances to pull it out, and we just couldn't do it.
Outside of that game against us, okay, not counting this game,
yeah,
Alabama's record for the season was 4-6 and 1-4 in conference.
Unbelievable. Yeah, how do we lose to that team? Because this would have, if we had won this game, we're a Van Tiffin field goal away from 8 straight wins over Alabama in the 80s. That's one of the things that's always eaten me up, is that we won in 82 and 83, and we win 4 more after these two. If we could have just won in 84 and 85, we could have made up almost that entire 70s Bear Bryant run of 9 wins over us. We could have almost made up the whole thing in one shot and gotten back on par with them. And we let 2 games get away that cancels out the 2 we had just won. And it just galls me. It burns me up. But this is there are 2 moments in this game worth noting, okay? One is we get down there, and it's like 4th and goal at the 1. And don't you think you give the ball to Bo Jackson over the top?
Yes.
What did we do?
Not remember? Do that.
Yeah, we gave it to Brent Fullwood on a sweep, and Bo ran the wrong way. And Alabama came up and just crushed Fullwood, made him lose yards, carried him out of bounds. And so we get the ball back later, and it's 17-15 Alabama, and we get all the way back down there again, and this time we go for the field goal, and Robert McGinney comes out to kick that short field goal, and what does he do?
He missed it.
He missed it. And what did Pat Dye do to Robert McGinney?
Robert McGinney transferred.
I believe Dye pulled his scholarship, and I honestly don't blame him. I think that Dye made it very clear to him he wasn't welcome on the team anymore. He was going to look for other kickers. And so McGinney transferred to Florida and
kicked against us.
And beat us 2 years later with like a 55-yard field goal. Because when he's kicking for Florida, he can make 55-yard field goals. But he's kicking for us, he can't beat Alabama with a chip shot. Ugh. This is the roller coaster we ride, John. This is what it's like to be an Auburn fan. So we finished that season and go off to the Liberty Bowl. We were 8-4, and we take an invitation to the Liberty Bowl.
We went to the Liberty Bowl. My family did.
To play Arkansas, right?
Yes, we played Arkansas in Memphis, and it was in December between Christmas and New Year's. And it was a miserable, it's Memphis in December, okay? It was a miserable week. It was like cold and rainy and freezing rain. And, you know, we had three young boys and my parents were stuck in a hotel room with us most of the time. And we were going crazy because it was too yucky to be outside running around. And the one thing I remember is we sat outside at the Liberty Bowl and there was a guy in our section. He was an Auburn fan, but he was so drunk. He said some curse words I had never heard before. and the stadium security came and took him away.
Oh, wow.
That's what I remember about the Liberty Bowl more than the game, beating Arkansas.
There you go. Well, that's it. I'm just looking at the attendance of that game was 50,108. I'm thinking without you guys, it would have been more like 50,100. So you did your part to flesh out, to bump up that attendance over 50,000. That's nice. But yeah, I mean, I like, you know, Memphis in May, you think yummy barbecue. Memphis in December, you think you can't even leave your hotel room to go watch the. And it's weird to think of us playing Arkansas
in a non-conference game.
Yeah, because they weren't. This was still 8 years away from them joining the SEC. And this was a. By the way, we still ended up third in the SEC this year, so it's not too bad. We ended up higher ranked than LSU, who was above us. And since Florida was on probation, LSU ends up going to the Sugar Bowl, and we basically finished second in terms of the bowls. How the Liberty Bowl is the second. You know, in fact, we ended up with as many losses, with as many wins as any team in the SEC that year, because Florida was 9-1-1. LSU was 8-3-1, because Nebraska beat the crap out of them in the Sugar Bowl. And we ended up 9-4-0. So we ended up, you know, 9 wins was as much as anybody got. You know who else got 9 wins that year? Kentucky. Figure that out.
A lot more than Alabama had.
Oh, yeah, more than Georgia, too.
The important thing there is that back then, the preseason kickoff classic things were extra games. Yeah. They weren't part of your schedule like now. We have these games the first week of the season. You played an 11-game schedule, and you got an extra game, a 12th game, when you played the kickoff classic. And then we played the bowl game for 13. So, I mean, and nobody else played 13 games.
Right.
Except for, like, us in Miami.
That's right. And, in fact, I've always pointed out that the calendar year 1984, Auburn played 14 football games. Because we played in the Sugar Bowl on January 1st, and then we played 13 more games. Including the kickoff classic and a bowl. So that's unheard of, a team play 14 games in one calendar year. So the other thing real quick about Arkansas was I remember they ran the flex bone. And I'm thinking, you really don't want to be trying to make the wishbone option more sophisticated. At this point, everybody's trying to get away from it. And there they are making it, unless that was that Ken Hatfield maybe?
I believe so.
Trying to make it.
Was it... what's his name who ended up at Notre Dame in South Carolina?
Lou Holtz?
Was it Lou Holtz or Hatfield? May have been Holtz.
It may have been Holtz, but I'm thinking Ken Hatfield. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I don't know that Holtz would have run the flex bone, but maybe it was. Okay. Anyway, let's see. So, again, 85. I'm just going to zip through some of the games real quick. The main thing memorable about 85 is Bo winning the Heisman. I mean, that's the main thing. We ended up like in the middle of the conference rankings. Not a great year. Another 4-loss season. We lose at Tennessee in a game where we went in number one and got ambushed. Remember, Pat Dye basically said it was an ambush. We go into Tennessee, and they had Robinson, that quarterback that was really good, and they threw all over us, and they stopped Bo.
Henderson comes back into the lineup. Bo Jackson has not been seen much in the second half because of the sore knee. 81 yards for him, 97 yards for Fullwood, the backup. And he's hurt. And Bo Jackson had 76 yards in the first half, so he's had 5 this half. Security people now lined up to keep the crowd off the field. Once the game is over, they'll let him go. And Walden winds up, throws it in the end zone. The pass is intercepted by Tommy Sims. And the Tennessee Volunteers have defeated the Auburn Tigers 38-20.
And they won 38-20. And there was a great Florida State game. October 12, another one of these great where we were number 12, and we dropped all the way to 14 at one point, but after the Tennessee loss, we were number 12. Florida State was number 4. This was a game that was like 28-27 in the fourth quarter, and then as the Birmingham News headline was, the dam breaks and AU wins by 32. Do you remember that game? Bo had some long runs, but we also, like, turned the ball over and ran back some easy fumble recoveries and stuff.
After it was all over, Bo Jackson described things perfectly.
And it just went haywire in the fourth quarter. It was like Twilight Zone out there.
As for Florida State, no excuses were necessary or offered.
I thought we'd win the ball game. The game, up the first 55 minutes, we were behind, what, 7 points, something like that, or 4 points or something. So we were in it for 55 minutes, and they busted it wide open.
The Seminoles fall to 4-1 and surely out of the top 10. Bob Warren, Channel 6, Eyewitness Sports, Tallahassee.
It all just kind of fell apart for them, but they were on the verge of getting it together as a program.
Yeah. Yeah, they were playing really well. They still didn't have the defense thing figured out, not until the next year when they get that great defensive coordinator. I can't think of his name. Mickey Andrews. But, yeah, that game was close right up in the fourth quarter. Bo went off on them, and just they kept throwing interceptions and fumbling and all that, and we 59-27. Just an amazing shellacking of a very good team. This was the game of steel. You already mentioned it. The game of steel, Birmingham News called it, on ABC. Again, we were on ABC 4 times that year, and we lost 3 of them. but we lost to at number. No, we were playing Florida at home, and we lost 14-10. It was a really low scoring game because there were such great defenses.
And I have to take a minute and talk about the players that were on Auburn's defense in '84 and '85.
Yeah,
I mean Kevin Green, Greg Carr, Gerald Robinson. We had a lot of great players in those on those teams. A lot of guys that went on to play, and then offensive line, Steve Wallace, Ben Tamborello, Stacy Searles, great offensive linemen. And we were in this run where we had had a guy that would end up playing tight end in the NFL for a long time.
That's right.
So a lot of good players in those teams outside of just the running backs.
Yeah, Jeff Parks, Ed West, all those guys. Eventually,
Walter Reeves.
Yeah, so many. We've had great tight ends over the years. In Florida, not only a great defense, Florida also had Neil Anderson, who went on to a good career with the Bears, and John L. Williams, who was the man for Seattle, for the Seahawks. Mm-hmm. So two big NFL running backs on that Florida team, too. We held them to 14 points, but they held us to 10. The Alabama game that year, I don't even want to talk about it, but this was the Van Tiffin field goal game where it went back and forth the whole game, and we actually led 23-22. I remember our big fullback, Reggie Ware, scoring a touchdown. I remember Bo doing an over-the-top touchdown, even though he had broken ribs. This is the game where he basically – this the Georgia game the week before is the one where he won the Heisman. It was on ABC, and we beat Georgia 24-10. And Bo went out there and ran all over them and all over Alabama, even though he had broken ribs. But in this Iron Bowl, it was back and forth. And then it was 23-22 Auburn with just like a minute to go. And old Mike Shula at quarterback – threw a pass, I want to say, was it Greg Richardson? And one of our, like, third-string defensive backs, I feel like it was Bivens, quote-unquote tackled him, which he was such a little guy, he jumped on Richardson's back, and Richardson just carried him out of bounds to stop the clock and set up a 52-yard field goal. And I remember watching Tiffin kick that 52-yard field goal while Keith Jackson announced it and hollered about it. And I remember just saying over and over, unbelievable, unbelievable, unbelievable. And when the Birmingham News came out the next morning, the headline was unbelievable.
It was unbelievable.
Oh, sickening. It was just absolutely, it was Bo's birthday. The cheerleaders all sang happy birthday to Bo before the game. And then we couldn't stop them from kicking that stinking, nasty, crappy, sorry old field goal. 25-23. This is the one where Pat Dye had hives after the game. He felt like he hadn't done enough, you know. And he decided after that, we're going to fix things.
CBS Sports Break, sponsored by imported Heineken beer.
Good evening. Auburn running back Bo Jackson tonight was awarded the Heisman Trophy. In the closest vote in history, Jackson beat Iowa's Chuck Long.
Bo Jackson, Auburn University, running back.
Yes, sir, and this year's Heisman Trophy winner. How about that, huh? He's some kind of open field runner. He is really tricky. In fact, he's so tricky, in the instant replays, he's doing something else.
Here's Jerry Hinnan from CBS Sports and the War Eagle Reader.
I feel like I vaguely remember the 1984 kickoff classic against Miami being on the TV and, you know, my dad kind of being upset about how things went in that game. But other than, you know, these tiny sort of after images of that thing, my first real memories are from 1985. And as cliched as it sounds, they're about Bo Jackson. Like, I remember watching the Southwestern Louisiana game. My parents brought me to that and seeing Bo take off, you know, on several, it felt like 50-yard touchdown runs down the sideline. Very specifically, I remember going to the Florida game that season. We had Florida fans behind me, which I feel like was the first time I'd really grasped the fact that there were fans of football teams other than Auburn, that people existed who didn't want Auburn to win football games, that wanted Auburn to lose. And so that was kind of mind-blowing. And unfortunately, Auburn did lose that game. If I remember correctly, Bo didn't play much or at all in that game. But then, you know, the first sort of play, the first single individual play I can remember watching as a football fan was Bo against Georgia. So they were playing in Athens. I'm pretty sure the game was on the TBS Superstation back when TBS was showing Saturday football games. And it was Bo's touchdown run where he cut back all the way across the field. It was, you know, maybe 60, 70-yard run. And after he'd gotten into Georgia territory, he'd cut back all the way across the field. And I just remember thinking, I've never seen anyone do that before. I didn't know you could, like, run one way and then run all the way the other way across the field. This is, oh, my gosh, mind-blowing. Even then, as a, I guess I had just turned seven, you know, you had the understanding that the guy who was carrying the ball, and of course I'd watched Bo all season, but, you know, again, just the understanding that the guy carrying the ball was an exceptional football player and not like all the other football players that were on the field. You know, again, it sounds cliche to say, oh, I'm an Auburn fan and the first thing I remember is watching Bo, but I'm an Auburn fan and the first thing I really remember is watching Bo.
And it's the next game is where he really decides to fix things, because we go out on January 1st. We had played in 83 in the 50th annual Sugar Bowl. Now we go out and play in the 50th annual Cotton Bowl.
We are live from the Cotton Bowl in Dallas. It is Texas A&M against the Auburn Tigers. And Pat Dye and the Tigers are coming out onto the field here in Dallas. They are led by the mighty Bo Jackson, who will go down in the record books as one of the greatest running backs ever to play the game of college football. A happy new year, everybody, and welcome to the Cotton Bowl. I'm Brent Musburger, along with Ara Parsegan and Jim Nance. For Jackson today, the task is a difficult one. Texas A&M is one of those young, improving teams. A&M wants to springboard from this classic into the preseason rankings next year. They would love to go in touted as one of the top five teams in all of college football. But to do that, they must stop Bo Jackson and the Auburn Tigers. And now the Aggies are coming onto the field. Their first Cotton Bowl since 1968, when they upset a mighty Alabama team. And they are led by a man who once played for Bear Bryant at Alabama, Jackie Sherrill. And the Aggies will come pouring onto this field, and the Cotton Bowl will explode. The coach, Jackie Sherrill. His fourth year, he arrived at Texas A&M from Pittsburgh. He has known some lean, tough times, but now he has risen to the top of the Southwest Conference, and his Aggies are primed for their biggest moment ever to take on the Auburn Tigers and the Heisman Trophy winner, Bo Jackson.
Well, this is one of the fun things about doing a bowl game. You get to go back and review what they've done the entire year, and the thing that really jumps out, Brent, is the versatility of college football and the contrast between these two teams. For example, Auburn is a running football team. They're going to keep that ball on the ground about 80% of the time, ordinary passing game. Texas A&M is a very versatile, multiple offensive football team, but yet both teams have averaged about 400 yards during the course of the season.
Now, how about some of the players? For example, Bo Jackson is such an enormous star.
Well, he's Mr. Everything, no question about that. Heisman Trophy winner. This is what he's done for this year. 278 rushes, as you see, 17 touchdowns.
Now, Aaron, there is a big difference, however, between these two offenses.
Exactly right, and that's at the quarterback spot. And the statistics bear that out. Pat Washington, as you see, a 45% passer. Murray, 58.6. But look at the difference in the touchdowns. 2 for Washington and 13. The outcome of this game could be determined by the performance of these two players.
And Texas A&M just runs all over us, but Bo had a couple of big plays. He also got stuffed at the goal line, I think, right after winning the Heisman Trophy. But after that game, Pat Dye said, we got to change some things. And so going into 86, it was made clear that Auburn was going to be a different team in 86. And we had a much better year. And so Jeff Berger had been recruited. And a quick thing about Jeff Berger, Berger said later that when he was recruited, when passing coaches would ask him, do you like more the option or the passing game? He'd tell them passing. And when it was running coaches, he'd tell them the option. I'm more of an option quarterback. He just told them what they wanted to hear. So he ends up at Auburn as, you know, an option quarterback. But in 1986, his junior year to be, we become more of a passing team. And even Pat Dye brought in Pat Sullivan to be the offensive coordinator, kind of the passing game, along with Larry Blakeney. And so we go to the I formation. Let me back up. We had gone to the I formation in 85 to give Bo a better chance to win the Heisman, and it did. But we now go to more of a passing I formation. Okay. I remember Aubie with his big airplane he ran around with that said Air Auburn on it. It may have been like a little car with wings and a tail, and it said Air Auburn. Okay. So what do you remember about the 86 season and going to that passing game and bringing in Trey Gaines, you know, well, we already had him, but having a senior in Trey Gaines and players like, I guess we had Duke Donaldson then, right, and a few of those other guys.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this was Lawyer Tillman's first big year to explode.
Yes. I mean, I just remember that it was exciting. Like, we had been, you know, tailback forever, and now we had this whole other way of scoring. It was, you know, threw the ball deep a lot, and the defense was great that year, too. Like, they absolutely crushed most teams. Nobody scored more than 14 points against us till November.
Yeah.
So, and the offense was rolling up and down the field. It really, really opened things up. Teams didn't know what to expect from us. And I think we had a lot of talent. They tried to bring everybody in the box, stop the running backs. It'd be some easy throws or Berger. And when they backed up, he could keep handing it off, and we'd keep chewing them up.
You know, you make a good point, too. And by the way, this was the year that backfield duo behind Berger of Tommy Agee, a senior, and Brent Fullwood, a senior, they really exploded. They were just a great running duo at fullback and tailback.
Absolutely.
But you make a good point that the defense doesn't get enough hype, because everybody remembers the defense being so good in 87, 88, 89. 90 wasn't bad either, but 87, 89.
This is when it started, though.
Here are the scores of our opponents in those games, those 12 games, real quick. Our opponents, now 14, but that was Chattanooga, and that was like against the Scrubs at the end. So 14, 0, 8, 6, 9, 10, 6, 18, 7, 20, and that was Georgia breaking 20, the only team to break 20 all year, 17, and 7. The ones I want to mention... We started 7-0 and worked our way up to number 7 in the country. I remember Mississippi State was number 13. They were undefeated. This was the game where Saturday Night Live even mentioned it during a skit. These two guys were in their basement and were bored, and they're like, what do you want to watch? And I was like, oh, Auburn's playing Mississippi State. And I'm thinking, wow, I never thought we'd ever hear that. But that was where Mississippi State was undefeated. We were undefeated. It was on ESPN, and Fullwood ran wild, and we killed them 35-6. And that's one of those times that the Mississippi State fans just kind of shake their heads, right, and say it's not easy being a Mississippi State fan.
Pitch to his tailback, sweeping to the short side, trying to get out. Side broken tackle, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, down the sideline, 45, the 40. They're not going to get him. He's going all the way. Touchdown, Auburn! 88 yards for Brent Fullwood.
But then we went down to Florida Field for the nightmare, where Florida had already won 2 in a row. We're leading them 17-10 late. And this is one of those games where Pat Dye is conservative. We'll see this again. We'll hear this song again. And Florida drives down with Kerwin Bell, who was injured, who's hobbling around on one foot. And they score, and they go for 2. And do you remember how they went for 2?
No.
Kerwin Bell kept it and just ran in on one foot, basically.
That's
I always
right.
say, Kerwin yeah. Bell wheeled his wheelchair into the end zone, and we couldn't stop him.
I hated that guy.
Oh, gosh. 18-17. So we finally lost after being 7-0 to stinking Florida in a game we led 17-10 late. And the reason that Florida had 10 when they went in to score to make it 18 was they had 7 and Robert McGinney kicked like a 55-yard field goal, the guy we had booted off the team 2 years earlier for losing to Alabama. Karma sucks. Now, we got to also mention a couple other games here. We got to mention go the rest of the way. Georgia that year was number 17. This was the nothing stinks like a wet dog game. I'll take this one away, John.
So, Georgia, the game was in Auburn. Georgia came into the game, and they were ranked in the top 20, but they had lost their starting quarterback, and they had to play their backup quarterback. And coming into Auburn against that defense and that team with their backup quarterback, we felt pretty good. Auburn felt like this is a year we're going to get Georgia. We're going to take it to them. Auburn was a big favorite, and Georgia had a great game. They pulled it out in the end, 20-16, and Auburn was devastated. The Georgia fans were going crazy in the stadium. Some of them went down on the field. Some of them were stayed in the stadium celebrating for a long time. And finally, the Auburn public address announcer asked them to leave the stadium and leave the field, and they didn't. So we turned the sprinklers on the field, and we turned the hoses on the ones in the stands and wet them down. This was at night in Auburn in November, and they sprayed them down and wet them down. And so the next year when we go to Georgia, this there's some payback coming for those of us who made that trip. But it was a huge scandal by – some of my relatives went to Georgia and some of my neighbors, and they were all just like, you can imagine if that happened today.
Oh, God.
If you hose down the other team's fans after a win in your stadium, imagine that? And they were so mad about that.
Yeah, well, they should have gotten out when they were told to. They were ripping up the turf, too, is what I understand.
They were.
Yeah. Not that we ever didn't mess with their hedges. There's a couple of notes.
I no comment.
Okay, there you go. That's what I thought. we won't go on the record about that. One of the things about that game was that Fullwood scored late, and they ruled that he had been whistled down. So without that referee phantom whistle, we would have won. Mm. This was also the game where we couldn't get anything going on the ground before that, and so Lawyer Tillman started catching everything that Berger threw anywhere near him, because I remember Vince Dooley saying, I didn't think we'd ever stop Tillman. He was killing us.
Walter Reeves, the tight end, moves from the left over to the right side. Auburn going with the unbalanced line with two split ends, and Berger setting up the throw and going long for Tillman. Oh, my goodness, what a catch! Oh, my! Oh, heavens to Betsy! Touchdown, Auburn! Unbelievable! An absolutely incredible catch by Lawyer Tillman. He was diving, grabbed the ball with his left hand, turned a complete flip into the end zone for the touchdown. I don't think I've ever seen a better one.
So those were the two game notes I remember from that. So we play against number 7 Alabama, and we were number 14, and we wanted revenge for the last 2 years. We're still at Legion Field. And all I'll say about this one, Brent Fullwood scored at the beginning of the second quarter, first play of the second quarter. He scored on the first play of the fourth quarter. And then coming down the stretch, it's 17-14 Alabama, and we get all the way down to like the Alabama, 10-yard line or something?
Mm-hmm.
And Pat Dye wants to run a reverse, and he's calling for Scott Bolton, our backup receiver and the little brother of my boss and yours at the AU bookstore years ago. And he can't find Bolton, or he can't remember his name or something, and Lawyer Tillman was in as a pass catcher, not as a reverse runner. So they just say, go ahead and run it, go ahead and run it. So he'd never run the reverse before, which probably helped because they weren't looking for it.
Berger, out of the eye, going to pitch to Jesse, and he's going to give it to Tillman on the end around, the 10, the 5, Tillman, he's in! Touchdown, Auburn! Touchdown, Auburn! Lawyer Tillman on the end around reverse! 32 seconds left! Auburn has gone ahead 20-17!
Berger gives it to Tim Jesse. Jesse pitches it to Tillman, and Tillman goes on the reverse end for the touchdown. And that's the famous reverse to victory 21-17.
Well, and Tillman was a much bigger receiver. So
yeah.
I think there was some contact as he got close to the goal line. I think it helped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did a good cut, and then he kind of smashed his way into the end zone. So we won that one. And our reward, I believe that we ended up second in the SEC and could have gotten in the Orange Bowl, but the Citrus Bowl in Orlando had already asked, and Dye had promised them we would come. And so a 9-2 at that point Auburn team goes down to the Citrus Bowl to play Southern Cal with their coach that ends up getting fired after this game. Tedford, I think his name was, or something. And he hadn't been a great USC coach. And Auburn, we beat them 16-7. The defense smothered USC completely. I feel like maybe we blocked a punt or something, you know.
And just it was a brutal game, very physical. Rodney Pete was the USC quarterback in that game. And they had a number of guys on defense went on to play in the NFL. Was it, I think, and maybe Marcus Allen was in this game? Was he already out, I think?
No, I think he was already out.
He was already out.
They weren't quite what they had been back then, but
no.
They still had a few good players. And, yeah, we beat them pretty solidly, and that was a good feeling to beat USC. All right, so we go on to 1987, and, again, there's just a few highlights I want to hit. We had just expanded the stadium. Berger comes back for his senior year at quarterback. The passing game is looking good. The defense is looking great. But Fullwood and AG are graduated. They're gone, off to the NFL. AG played for Dallas for a long time. Fullwood went off to Green Bay, where I think in his first touch of the ball, he fumbled a kickoff out of bounds in the end zone. Not great. But in 87, there's high hopes, high expectations. We were ranked number 5 going into the season. But they've just expanded the stadium. This is when they had just built the East Deck and put in the luxury suites before 87. And I was at that opening game because they wanted a big-name opponent to open the new upper deck.
Texas quarterback Brett Stafford holds or shares 14 Longhorn passing records after 2 years as a starter. One of his favorite targets is Eric Metcalf. The junior was a Southwest Conference All-Star a year ago when he ran for 310 yards and caught passes for 556 more. Metcalf is a world-class long jumper. He won the NCAA championship, and his speed is one of the biggest threats the Longhorns have. Texas will do everything it can to get the ball to Metcalf. Dye enters his seventh year with a 52-20 record at Auburn and a veteran ball club that has a chance to win it all. The Tigers are led by quarterback Jeff Berger. The senior's passing ability will be needed more this year, and he has a great core of receivers led by Lawyer Tillman, a tremendous leaper who averaged more than 20 yards a catch in 1986. But a championship for the Tigers will depend on defense, led by All-American Tracy Rocker, one of 8 returning starters. This is Jordan-Hare Stadium in Auburn, where we expect a crowd of 80,000 people here today. That would be a new record for a football game in the state of Alabama. And here come the Texas Longhorns, embarrassed a year ago with that 5-6 record. But if they can stay healthy, the players believe they can turn it around in 1987. And that roar is for the Auburn Tigers, ranked 5th in the preseason polls. Coach Pat Dye once again has his club in a position to contend for an SEC title and possibly a national championship.
And so we got Texas to come in because we wanted some payback. Well, Texas was not what they had been in 83-84. Fred Akers had been fired. They brought in David McWilliams. And we beat the snot out of Texas.
Well, better things there. There's Jeff Berger to the right, Pat Sullivan to the left. Berger told us yesterday that he thought Sullivan gave him the confidence to be a great quarterback, and that's what you need.
We're down to 2 seconds left, 1 second, and that's it. The game is over. And the Texas Longhorns have gone down to defeat here at Auburn, 31-3, as the Tigers showed just a solid, solid defense. They were really able to stop Texas every time.
Great way to open the upper deck.
My friends and I were on our way down to Panama City, and we stopped. I guess this was before school started or something. I don't remember. But anyway, we stopped, watched the game. It was spectacular. This was when Greg Staples had just, like, transferred or something. I don't think he was a freshman. I think he had transferred or something at safety. And he absolutely smacked a guy in midair and just took the ball away from him in midair, like one of those Matrix-type scenes in slow motion. And this is the game where our big linebacker, Kirk Crane, actually hugged the referee. So it was just a total butt-kicking of Texas. They didn't know, because they came in thinking we were going to run or something, and we threw all over them, I remember. Skipping on down, we had that epic 2020 tie at Neyland Stadium with Tennessee. This was the one where they had the Cobb-Webb connection, Reggie Cobb and whatever his name Webb was.
Chuck Webb.
Chuck Webb, right.
I'm still mad about that game.
We threw the ball better. They ran the ball better. We had, remember in 87, our running backs were depleted, and now we were with, we were pretty much using.
Is this James Joseph? And
James Joseph's freshman.
Stacy Danley.
I'm sorry. James Joseph's freshman year was in Tennessee. It was in 85. But he got hurt, too. He, like, broke his kneecap or something. So we had a rehab James Joseph and Stacy Danley as our running duo, yeah, who were okay. They were pretty good. They weren't, you know, world beaters, but they were serviceable. Both of them were very good, serviceable, and tough, you know, tough. And we end up tying. I remember this is a game where Win Lyle kicks, like, a 50-yard field goal or something, or 55-yard field goal. But Tennessee comes back and ties it, and it's 20-20.
You got to talk about the Georgia Tech game.
Oh, the Georgia Tech game. I looked at the score, and it didn't strike me as notable. But, yeah, the score is deceptive, isn't it?
It is.
This is the game where it looks like we're going to lose until, like, the last 30 seconds. So take it away.
So this was the game at Georgia Tech in Atlanta in October, and Auburn was a much higher-rated team, and Georgia Tech wasn't ranked. We were expected to kill them. But Georgia Tech played a really good game. I was sitting in the Georgia Tech students section with some of our other Auburn friends and a lot of my Georgia Tech friends, and we were wearing the shirts, you know, the Tiger Rag shirts for that game. And Georgia Tech played a great game. I think it was tied at halftime, or they were ahead, and they were ahead. But this was the game, the one-man kind of wrecking crew game for future number one draft pick Andre Bruce.
Yes.
Where he had an absolutely dominating game. I think he had multiple sacks. Hmm. And then late in the game, he had an interception that he returned for a touchdown.
Last play of the game, I think.
And it was the last play of the game, and they made the final score 20-10. And this was the game that all the Falcons scouts must have been in attendance at, because it was in Atlanta, that caused them to pick Andre Bruce with the number one pick the next year.
Oh, that was one of those great classic Falcons picks, too. But
we were Auburn fans, and we didn't think that was a good pick. That should tell you.
Right, that should sum it up. Yeah, here's the final sequence very quickly. It was actually 10-7 Georgia Tech with like a minute to go. And Auburn drove down the field, and on, like, I don't know if it's fourth down or whatever, Berger takes a snap and hits Lawyer Tillman in the back of the end zone for a touchdown, and Jim Fife loses his mind.
One set back is Harris. Here is motion by Donaldson back to the near side, and now reverses his field, goes to the wide side of the field. Berger sets up the throw. Oh, my! Touchdown, Auburn! Touchdown, Auburn! Touchdown, Auburn! Tillman, Tillman, Tillman! Tillman at the baseline of the end zone. A bullet by Berger. Auburn goes ahead. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Tillman from Berger. Touchdown, Auburn. 13-10. Tigers lead with 13 seconds.
And he screams and yells.
He wasn't the only one.
No. And so it's now 14-10, Auburn. Georgia Tech gets the ball back with a few seconds to go, and they come out and try a long pass. And it's intercepted by Andre Bruce, who runs it all the way back for a touchdown. They didn't kick the extra point. So we win 20-10, a game we were losing 10-7 just a few seconds earlier. And it had to just been shell-shocking for Georgia Tech fans.
It was. It was a lot of fun for us, though. It was. You have never seen a fan base that had the rug yanked under them. Again, we were number five in the country, and they were unranked, and they were beating us the whole game, and they could taste it. They wanted to beat us, and at the last minute, we won that game, and their entire fan base was just devastated. That whole night, they were just couldn't handle it.
Just remember, this is back in that run where Pat Dye was just handing Bill Curry his lunch every year. I mean, we had a streak going against Tech game after game, like 9 in a row or 12 in a row or something unbelievable, yeah. Okay, so after that, we got to talk about
the other one I want to mention is the Halloween game.
Halloween. Oh, yeah.
Florida at Jordan-Hare at night on ESPN on Halloween.
The nightmare in Jordan-Hare was what the T-shirt said.
That was it.
Here they come, the Tigers of Auburn, led on by head coach Pat Dye. A lot of controversy on this campus this week, but the squad has put it all behind them, and the fans, there are 85,000 here on a Saturday night. It becomes the fifth largest city in the state of Alabama. They don't care, because the Gators are the opponent. It's Halloween night. Who'll get the trick, and who'll get the treat?
And this is the one that ESPN billed as the irresistible force versus the immovable object. And the irresistible force was Florida's freshman sensation, Emmitt Smith. And the immovable object was Andre Bruce, believe it or not. And
the whole Auburn defense.
Yeah. And this was not a very creative Florida team on offense. And they just hammered Emmitt Smith at us, and we stopped him. And it was 29-6, and I just remember being so happy that we had crushed Florida after 3 years of frustration.
Yep, it's Happy Halloween, and there'll be some celebrating. What was that drugstore we had the lemonade at?
Oh, don't ask me that. What was it?
The best homemade lemonade ever.
Toomer's Corner, where they will be celebrating tonight. They say they get as much as 12,000 out there throwing toilet paper after a win. They go get some.
29-6 is our score, and you have to go back in the record book to 1977 to find the last time Auburn has scored 29 points. They beat Florida then 29-14.
I did not figure to be that big a margin of victory, but Florida giving up, as I said, just over 9 points a game. How about the year, Auburn doing the same thing.
How about the Gators on the ground? Their season average, 229 yards, just 61 tonight. I think Kerwin Bell is going to be seeing blue jerseys for about three nights. Andre Bruce in the backfield where he has lived, and it's picked off by Auburn. Carlos Cheatham, number 35, down at the 40-yard line, and that'll close the book. Going back to Carlos Cheatham, out of Muscle Shoals High School in Alabama. There he is with the interception. He is so shy that it was 3 years before he went to any of the sports publicity people at Auburn and said, "My name is Carlo, not Carlos." Took him 3 years to speak up after they had listed him as Carlos. Well, they'll look ahead to Florida State. And Pat Dye, who grew up in Blythe, Georgia, near Augusta, used to get up before dawn to perform the chores on his farm, hitch a ride to town in a milk truck. Said that his mother and father perhaps influenced him the most. He had two brothers, Wayne and Nate. Pat told me last night he was 15 before he won his first fight. So Pat Dye could have his Tigers of Auburn headed to the Sugar Bowl in New Orleans. A 29-6 win against Florida.
That was one of the sweeter wins I can ever remember as an Auburn person, was just beating the snot out of Florida on Halloween night at home after they'd beaten us 3 years in a row.
I mean, a home game at night on TV against Florida where we beat the crud out of them and their All-American running back and hold him down, and that really was one of the most fun games in Jordan-Hare.
Yeah, it really was. And then the next week, it's the exact opposite. November the 7th, Florida State comes in. This is the game where we found out that Andre Bruce didn't know Florida State was not in the SEC. Because we get killed in this game by Florida State. We're probably down after an emotional high of winning those last five in a row there. And Florida State comes in all hyped up. But, of course, it's on CBS, so we're going to lose it. That's the way it was going back then. 34-6, Florida State. But the very first play, Berger takes a snap and throws a ball out to the receiver in one of those quick screens. Donaldson catches it, goes about 10 yards, looks like he's going to make a first down, and then fumbles it. And Florida State cashes in, and immediately we're in the hole 7-0. The other important thing that happens this game, it's the only game we lost all year, by the way. The other thing that happens important in this game is do you remember what happened on like the last play of the game? Pat Dye didn't want Florida State to score again, so he put the first team defense back out on the final series. And on the last play of the game, we're all like filing out of the stadium. We look back, and the stretcher's going out there. Tracy Rocker tore up his knee in this game.
Yeah, that was an all-time not good coaching decision right there.
No.
You're All-American, the guy that would go on to win the Lombardi Award.
And the Outland.
Is the best, and the Outland is the best defensive lineman in the country. You had him on the last play of the game in a game that you were losing 34-6.
Right, yeah. And, I mean, he plays in 88 and is great. But he just was never quite the same again, you know. And he didn't have a big NFL career either, which he should have. So that always really ate me up that he went in there and got hurt. We go to Georgia, win a good game. I think this is the one where we actually, everything was going our way to the point that, like, Alexander Wright on a reverse fumbled the ball in midair, turned around, caught it, and scored a touchdown. So I remember my roommates and I all saying, you know, when you can fumble a reverse, catch it in midair, and score a touchdown, you know things are going your way, and it did. So we won that.
I went to this game in Athens, and this was a game where the Georgia fans wanted revenge for the hosing.
Yes.
So they all showed up with, like, water pistols and stuff, and wherever Auburn fans, a bunch of Auburn fans wore ponchos, and wherever we went, the Georgia fans were grousing about the hoses, and they were trying to spray us with their water guns and stuff. But we won, and I remember Lawyer Tillman had a big catch in this game, too, to put it away. So, and I got a big piece of the hedge, I'll tell you
that. There you go. Didn't you ring the bell or something, too?
I did. There's a victory bell on Georgia's campus. They ring after big games.
Yeah.
And we were walking back across the campus that night, and I asked my Georgia friends, like, what that was. And they said, oh, it's the victory bell. We students go and fans, and they ring it after games. And I sprinted across the lawn and grabbed the rope and rang that sucker.
I love it. Oh, I remember you telling that story before.
The
I love
Georgia
it.
Georgia fans were so mad.
I bet they were. But it was a great victory. Why shouldn't they celebrate? Yeah. Okay, so the Alabama game that year, I was at it in Legion Field. It was 10-0. It was really just a case of our defense being so suffocating, and Alabama, with kind of a backup quarterback, that David Smith guy, never a really great quarterback, they just didn't have a lot of offense, so 10-0. But it was great to shut Alabama out. I remember the bumper sticker J&M said was shut down, shut out, shut up. And so, you know, we had finished the season with one tie at Tennessee and one loss to Florida State. So we get to go to the Sugar Bowl. We outright won the SEC, 5-0-1, 9-1-1 overall, and we go to play Syracuse. And it's on ABC, and Syracuse was number 4. They were undefeated and wanting to be able to claim a share of the national championship. What do you remember about this game? I don't want to go into huge detail about it. It's honestly not worth our time, but just let's
remember, I mean, their quarterback was Don McPherson.
Yes.
And their coach was Dick McPherson.
Yes.
And I remember they were good. They had some good players. They were good on the quarterback was good. And they had some good defensive players. And I just remember that we had a chance at the end, and Dye chose to kick the field goal and tie the game rather than throw the ball in the end zone and go for the win. And the Syracuse fan, the coaches were really mad.
They hated it. Yeah, McPherson, the coach, came out and, like, slapped Dye's hand rather than shaking hands with him, and Dye just stood there laughing. They sent a bunch of ugly ties to Pat Dye. He signed them and auctioned them off for charity for scholarships. And then we sent a bunch of sour grapes to Syracuse.
The other great thing about this year is Alabama finished 7-5. But
yeah, that's always a good thing, sure. But in that game, they were saying that our receivers were being held. Basically, they were tackling Lawyer Tillman every play. And so 16-16, we just decided to go ahead and kick the field goal and get the tie. So we ended up 9-1-2, but with only one loss, which is odd. And so we go into 88. We lose Jeff Berger, but pretty much everybody else was back. And we had a kicker now in Win Lyle we felt good about. So this will be the last season we're going to cover on this episode. On our next episode, we're going to pick up with the first time ever season and kind of into the early 90s. 88 was a big, big year for Auburn with just one big disappointment that kind of spoiled the whole thing. And, John, we've talked before about how it's so hard on the one hand to want to fully appreciate a good season, but on the other hand, you end up with a bad taste in your mouth if you know that something could have been just a little bit better or a lot better if not one thing had happened, you know?
That's right.
And this is the perfect example because I love this 88 team, but I know you really love this 88 team.
I love the 88 team, and I was a sophomore, and I went to every game that I could. And it was a great – I mean, I love defense, and this was, I think, the in my opinion, the best Auburn defense we've ever had. They were amazing. They were dominating. Mm-hmm. They shut other teams down. They didn't allow an inch if they could. Mm-hmm. And really, really, you know, destroyed a lot of other teams that year. And they were so close. Yeah. I mean, so close to winning the national title this season that it's just agonizing.
Here's the scores. I'm going to do like I did the other one. Here are the scores that we allowed the other team to score in these games. 10, 7, 6, 21 from North Carolina because we're playing the Scrubs late. 7, 0, 0, 0. That's like something from 1957. 8, 10, 10, 13. What's unbelievable is that the two games we lost were when the opponent scored 7 and 13. Because in those two games combined, we scored one touchdown and two field goals. So our problem wasn't defense. Our problem was that against the better teams, our offense either wasn't quite enough or wasn't allowed to be maybe as much as it could be. We just weren't very freewheeling and open on offense, especially against LSU. So very quickly, we beat Tennessee, we beat Kentucky, we beat Kansas. We crushed Tennessee. Oh, that was a great game. I loved that game so much. That's the game where Shan Morris had the big sack on Reggie Cobb, 38-6. We beat North Carolina. Remember my geography professor was a big North Carolina guy, but he says, no, I'm cheering for Auburn. Then we go down on October 8th. We go down to LSU, and this is the earthquake game where we led the whole game 6-0, and you had to think, we need more points. We need more points. Six may not hold up.
This will decide it. 1:47 left. LSU 4th and 10 from the Auburn 11. Williams and Moss, that's what I would think. 4th down, 10 yards to go. 1:47 to go in the game. LSU wins or loses on this play, it would appear.
Here's a little personal, kind of funny story, kind of funny, kind of horrible story from me about that 1988 LSU game. Many years later, in 2005, I was flying on American Airlines from, I believe, Dallas to Tokyo on my way to Singapore. And they offered at that time several options. You could watch a movie, you could watch a sporting event, could watch the radar of the plane kind of over the globe, see where you were. There were, you know, three, just a handful of options. And one of the options they offered was a college football game. It was one of like only four options available. It was a college football game, and it was the 1988 Auburn LSU game. And I was thinking, why in the world did they choose that game to offer to us to watch on this flight? That's just a strange choice, because that was like 17 years, I'm doing the math really quickly here, later, and they were offering, you know, watch that game. And so I watched a little bit of it, because it had been 17 years since I'd seen it, obviously. And I was like, oh, yeah, it was as horrible as I remember, oh, so depressing. I stayed in Singapore for like 2 months, and 2 months later, I'm flying back home on an American flight that goes this time from Tokyo to Chicago. So it wasn't even the return leg of the same flight. It was months later going to a different city, and they offered several options of what you could watch, and one of them was the Auburn LSU game from 1988 again. And I'm thinking, I'm trapped in some kind of nightmare loop here, like The Matrix or Inception or something. So that was not fun. Here's Jeremy.
The 88 LSU game, I mean, it was, we were doing so well, and we were obviously like so good. And I'm sitting there with my dad, my uncle, and we've got a Pizza Hut pizza on the spread out on the Auburn footstool, like my dad's college footstool that I still have. And we're sitting there watching it. We lose. And I was just so, I couldn't believe it, because this was going to be a great year. This was happening. I mean, this was it. And like, I straight up went upstairs and threw up at 8 years old, or like, I guess 8 or 9 years old. I was so upset. And it wasn't like my dad was sobbing. It was like my dad was like, oh, you know, and I was upset like that. Or it wasn't like I'd been told, like, this is what you do, like when your team loses, so, and you go and vomit or anything. I was just, as a kid, I had become that it had become that much a part of my life that, like, I don't know, it was so weird. And the LSU and at night and the way it happened and everything, it was just, I don't know, I literally threw up.
And that was not a great LSU team. They ended up 8-4, but danged if they didn't put together a drive. And I believe it was Eddie Fuller caught a pass on like the last play of the game.
Tommy Hodson.
Oh, Tommy
last
Hodson.
Last play of the game to beat us.
7-6.
And the crowd jumping around so loud, so much excitement at the end of that game that it literally registered on the seismograph in the LSU, one of the science buildings. So they called it the earthquake game. And it was a devastating loss.
And we ended up, because of that, 10-1 going into a bowl. We still go to the Sugar Bowl. But at 10-1, we end up catching number 4 Florida State. If we'd been 11-0 going to the Sugar Bowl, who would have come to play us in New Orleans as an independent, John?
Notre Dame.
Notre Dame. Undefeated Notre Dame versus undefeated Auburn in our conference's bowl stadium, the Sugar Bowl.
Oh, we'd have killed them.
Oh, man. Oh, I wanted to play them so bad. And we end up...
That was the Tony Rice, Rocket Ismail Notre Dame team.
Yeah. And we end up instead, I believe Stonebreaker, wasn't he their big defensive guy?
Yep.
We end up playing a meaningless game against Florida State.
Welcome to the Superdome in New Orleans for the 1989 Sugar Bowl between the Florida State Seminoles and the Auburn Tigers.
And so the Superdome in New Orleans filled the capacity, about 75,000 to look on. Bobby Bowden on the left, and what a tremendous job he has done at Florida State, turning their football program into a powerhouse program. And on the right, Pat Dye, who played at Georgia. He was a teammate there in the early 50s of Fran Tarkenton, and then began his coaching career as an assistant on Bear Bryant's staff at Alabama. Came to Auburn in 1981 and takes his team, as does Bowden, to a 7th consecutive bowl game.
I see both of them, though, Al, were not following in the footsteps of the Bear. Both of them wearing hats inside the Superdome. Didn't Bear Bryant once say, "I'm not going to wear a hat"? My mama told me never to wear a hat when I was indoors.
He filed the old houndstooth cap away whenever he came in.
Yep.
For Auburn, Chris Johnson will be kicking off. The Auburn Tigers were co-champions of the Southeastern Conference. They shared that title with Louisiana State, and it's up to the Sugar Bowl committee to decide. Were it head-to-head, it would be LSU here, but normally the committee opts to go with the higher-rated team, and thus it is Auburn with its 10-1 overall mark.
And you'll hear the chant, "War Eagle,"
from the Auburn backers.
We played them tough.
I got to talk about the end of this game. So we went to the Superdome that year. We went to the Sugar Bowl. Of course, we don't like Florida State fans, and I don't like Florida State to begin with because I sat through the 34-6 game the year before, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we're in the Superdome. We're winning. Then we're losing. We're driving down the field at the end of the game. We're in the end zone that Auburn is driving towards. And let me just say, like, if you we haven't played Florida State much recently other than the national title game.
Right.
If you have not been in a stadium when they're playing the stupid chant for hours and hours, you have no idea how annoying that could be. And let me just say that an indoor dome with that chant is 10 times worse.
Yeah.
And at the end of that game, we drove down the field. They threw the ball in the end zone, and Deion Sanders was playing defensive back for Florida State, pushed down the helmet of the Auburn receiver from behind, and the ball bounced off the Auburn guy's chest and was incomplete. The next play, Deion Sanders intercepted the ball in the end zone to end the game. He then ran down the Auburn sideline, individually taunting everyone on the team, including the coaches and Bo Jackson, who was on the sideline.
Yeah.
So
unbelievable. I believe that was Freddie Wagan that got totally blatantly interfered with, and how the referees didn't see that is just beyond me.
Slack throwing, knocked down.
Oh, that looked like interference initially.
Ooh. Wagan, the intended receiver, and Dodge covering.
Ooh. Looked like Dodge made contact before the ball got there. I think we're going to have to look at this.
Dodge alternates with Butler, who hit the pit, put the hit on Watson a moment ago, and he puts the hit this time on.
You be the judge. That's Derek Dodge coming in from behind. That's interference. Oh! And you just see that on the board right here. Derek Dodge gets away with manslaughter. They'll be talking about this one in Alabama for a while.
Third and 10 from the 22. Slack picked off by Primetime.
What timing?
Neon Deion with his name up in lights.
We were first down
so
on like
mad
a 10.
Walking out of that stadium. Oh, so mad.
It was ridiculous. Yeah, Sammy Smith was their big running back, and it was a great duel. But I believe we threw a touchdown pass to Walter Reeves in this game, our only touchdown. But 13-7, it was Reggie Slack's last game. We haven't really talked about Slack, but he came in after Jeff Berger graduated and got to play 2 years. And Reggie Slack, I think, is one of the more underappreciated quarterbacks. I thought he was a great quarterback for us for those two huge years. 88 and 89.
He was steady, he was productive, and he was good in tight situations, in important situations. I think he really played well.
He really was great, yeah. So, a couple other things I didn't mention. We go to Florida. I got to mention, because we were so frustrated with that 18-17 game in 86, we go back down there in 88. Florida schedules us on their homecoming, Gator Growl, and we beat them 16-0 on their home field on their homecoming. You gotta love that. Come on. And on ESPN too. And then we beat Georgia 20-10. And then there's a fairly nondescript win over Alabama 15-10. I remember some controversy over was Reggie Slack past the line of scrimmage when he threw the ball on a scoring drive or something. But other than that, did just enough to win. And so we end that season 10-2, 6-1, SEC champions for a second year, co-champions with LSU because they beat us. We're both 6-1. But let's kind of wrap things up for this run through 84 through 88. We talked about the beginning, coming out of that 83 team that was such an overachieving, huge bunch. And then we saw two kind of disappointing years with Bo, though we do get the Heisman Trophy. And then 86, 87, 88, three really good seasons, something disappointing every year in that run. But still, 86, 87, 88 was a spectacular three-year run. And before we wrap up with John's thoughts on that, I wanted to see what Jerry Hinnon thought about the impact that our great late 80s teams had on the overall mindset of the Auburn people going forward. Where do you place that in Auburn history? And as a supplement to that, did it spoil us? I mean, did we know at the time we were going through probably the greatest period in Auburn history, short of a national championship, and start thinking that that was the norm?
It's certainly possible. I think that probably is something of an issue for Auburn fans of my particular generation, where we grew up with the Pat Dye years. And, you know, I still remember being sort of vaguely disappointed on a couple of occasions. I do remember, like, this is another thing I remember about the 1985 season. I was a big Sports Illustrated quote-unquote reader. I didn't actually read the articles, but I loved getting the magazine out of the mailbox, loved looking over the pictures, and I very clearly remember, I think Tony Banks was the name of the Tennessee quarterback who was on the cover of Sports Illustrated under the headline, "The Tennessee Waltz," after the Vols had completely stomped Auburn that season, with Auburn coming in as the number one team in the country. Even though we came up during those Dye years, we still remember being disappointed. I remember Sports Illustrated, again, had like their top 25 in the magazine, or top 20 back then, every week. And I remember being so excited. I think it was 88, the earthquake game. They got all the way up to number 3. And I was just like, oh, my gosh, they're number 3. Ah! And they lost the earthquake game. You know, it didn't work out. So I remember, even though we're talking about during the Dye years, I think you still got tastes of what it could be like to be an Auburn fan at times, to have your hopes as high as a 9-year-old boy could let their hopes get up and then just not work out. But at the same time, I do think there's something to the idea that people of my Auburn fans of my particular generation who are raised on, okay, well, we're going to go to the Sugar Bowl every other year, pretty much whenever we feel like it, that wasn't necessarily always going to be reality. I think probably has colored our perception somewhat, as opposed to, you know, the folks who came of age, I would guess, in the late 60s and 70s, that kind of thing. That said, you know, when I think about the late 80s, it's still overwhelmingly positive. I remember beating Florida State in multiple sort of like, okay, here's another bunch of jerkwads from the state of Florida. They're really good. And Auburn won those games as often as they lost them, even if Auburn wasn't winning national championships. And obviously, you know, the earthquake game stands out as being, you know, I also have this sort of vague recollection of watching bowl games that year and all, my dad saying, if we hadn't, Notre Dame was playing, and he said, if we hadn't have lost to LSU, we'd be playing Notre Dame for a national championship right this second, and thinking, oh, he's right. That game was bad enough already. But, you know, for all of that kind of disappointment, you still had, you know, those huge triumphs every year. And, you know, obviously, in some ways, that entire era culminated with the 1989 Iron Bowl.
Oh, the 1989 Iron Bowl. First time ever in Jordan-Hare. That'll be a major part of the topic of our next show. But now let's wrap up with John and finish up this great run in the late 1980s. What are your thoughts looking back on those three seasons now?
I mean, the first thing I think about is, again, 87-88, we won the SEC.
87-88-89, we won it 3 years in a row.
That's right. So I think that's the first and most important thing, is we won the SEC 3 years in a row.
And beat Alabama.
That's right. And so, but also, there's this kind of bittersweet taste because the 88 team, I believe that they were the best team in the country.
Yeah,
they were. And they had one of those weird night game in Baton Rouge situations happen to them where LSU pulled a miracle out of their rear end at the end of the game and won.
Oh, John, and point out, we didn't play LSU every year. We weren't in divisions.
No.
We could have been playing Vanderbilt that year as easily as LSU.
That's it. We didn't – again, you're correct. People are going to forget this. There were no divisions at the time. LSU was not an every-year opponent for us. No. You know, we played Georgia and Florida and Alabama every year. We did not play LSU every year. So they had rotated onto our schedule instead of Vanderbilt or some of these other teams. Oh, like Ole Miss. We could have been playing Ole Miss. And instead, we played them, and they were really good, and they, you know, pulled a miracle out at the end and beat us. And that was tough. That was a tough loss. And then the Florida State loss was a tough loss. I really feel like both those games we had a real good chances to win and we didn't. I still love this team, though. I mean, they were tough. They had great defense and they were really fun to watch.
There has been considerable drama here in Legion Field today. Pat Dye, you know, with this 9-1-1 record, he moved ahead of Georgia coach Vince Dooley and into eighth place on the scroll of the nation's winningest active coaches in terms of winning percentage. Pat Dye, head coach at East Carolina, then at Wyoming. After 1 year at Wyoming, he was offered the head job at Auburn. He called Bear Bryant, his former boss at Alabama, and said, should I take the Auburn job? And Bear said, no, I wouldn't do that if I were you, because if you take it, I'm going to whoop you. And Pat said, well, Bear, that may be true, but whoever follows you, I'm going to whoop them like a stepson. And he took the job, and he hasn't exactly whooped him, but he does have a 4-3 edge. And he's made major progress. They've made the stadium larger. They're trying to move the game to a home and away series where they'll have Alabama in Auburn. The program has not only arrived, but it continues to get better. And he has given Auburn supporters a kind of pride that they did not enjoy during all of the years that Bryant and Alabama was able to dominate them and the great Shug Jordan in the 60s and 70s.
And I guess for me, I look back at those three seasons there, the 86, 87, 88, and I think that that was when you and I were students, right? That was in our years, among our years. And it just felt good. This was really the first time that Auburn people could stand up in that state and say, we are every bit as good or better at football than Alabama, right? I mean, there was no more looking at this behemoth over us. These were the years that we were the bully. We were the ones taking the milk money, not Alabama. Alabama was, you know, in a good year about equal to us in those years, but we beat them 4 years in a row there. We were winning the SEC. They only got one SEC championship in that run. We got three in a row. We were the big guy. Alabama fans were talking about, man, I wish Pat Dye was our coach. You know, they hated him, but they respected him. And so that was the first time in my life that I ever, it's like power goes to your head. You know, you're just walking around a little straighter. you can look those Bama fans in the eye and just give it right back at them measure for measure, whereas before you kind of had to say, well, yeah, Bears kicking our ass, you know. But now we could look at them in the eye at least equal, if not look down on them a little bit. Shug Jordan had talked about the Auburn mindset that we were just second rate, unfortunately, and that's just how it was, and we had found ways to deal with it. But the new Auburn mindset was we are at least as good, if not better than you on the football field. This was a hugely psychologically important period for Auburn fans, because I would argue this laid the foundations for us having confidence and feeling like our program was as good as anybody in the country. And it's why to this day when Alabama fans act like we're somehow second or third class football citizens, it just seems so ridiculous to us, because we know after the 80s, we're on the same plane as anybody else. We're on that top heavyweight level. And I know they don't want to believe it, but it's true. And these were the years that sealed that deal. These were not flukes. There was no luck. There was no kick six, no miracle at Jordan-Hare, no punt Bama punt. These were years we beat the snot out of you by just being so good and having that defense and that running game, and just being tough, right? That's why people love and respect Pat Dye still. It wasn't razzle-dazzle and trickery and anything like that. And that has its place. Don't get me wrong. That has its place. This was just going out there man-to-man and punching each other in the nose and seeing who gets up. And more often than not, it was us getting up.
That's a good way of putting it.
All right.
First, I want to congratulate you, of course, on being the Southeastern Conference champions. I know that this is a proud day for all of you and for your university, for your entire state, and for the whole conference. Today, you know, you can stand a little bit taller and say to yourself that you're a champion. For the rest of your lives, you're going to have a ring on your finger that's going to say you're the best damn team in the Southeast.
I'm so happy for you to win it outright, and well, we only got one champion in the conference. You are the champion of the best football conference in America.
We Believed is a production of the AU Wishbone and White Rocket Entertainment in association with thewareaglereader.com. I'm Reynolds Wolf. The show was produced and engineered by Van Allen Plexico and John Ringer, and brought to you by all of our great supporters on patreon.com. To join the AU Wishbone family, visit auwishbone.com. War Eagle.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.